The Mission of Count von Stauffenberg. This was a man of astonishing gifts for a professional army officer. Born in 1907, he came from an old and distinguished South German family. Through his mother, Countess von Uexküll-Gyllenbrand, he was a great-grandson of Gneisenau, one of the military heroes of the War of Liberation against Napoleon, and the co-founder, with Scharnhorst, of the Prussian General Staff, and through her also a descendant of York von Wartenburg, another celebrated general of the Bonaparte era. Klaus's father had been privy chamberlain to the last king of Württemberg. The family was congenial, devoutly Roman Catholic, and highly cultivated. With this background, and in this atmosphere, Klaus von Stauffenberg grew up. Possessed of a fine physique, and, according to all who knew him, of a striking handsomeness, he developed a brilliant, inquisitive, splendidly balanced mind. He had a passion for horses and sports, but also for the arts and literature, in which he read widely, and as a youth came under the influence of Stefan George and that poetic genius's romantic mysticism. For a time, the young man thought of taking up music as a profession, and later architecture, but in 1926, at the age of 19, he entered the army as an officer cadet in the 17th Bamberg Cavalry Regiment, the famed Bamberger Reiter. In 1936, he was posted to the War Academy in Berlin, where his all-round brilliance attracted the attention of both his teachers and the high command. He emerged 2 years later as a young officer of the General Staff. Though, like most of his class, a monarchist at heart, he was not up to this time an opponent of National Socialism. Apparently it was the anti-Jewish pogroms of 1938 which first cast doubts in his mind about Hitler, and these increased when, in the summer of 1939, he saw that the Führer was leading Germany into a war which might be long, frightfully costly in human lives, and in the end, lost. Nevertheless, when the war came, he threw himself into it with characteristic energy, making a name for himself as a staff officer of General Hübner's 6th Panzer Division in the campaigns in Poland and France. It was in Russia that Stauffenberg seems to have become completely disillusioned with the Third Reich. He had been transferred to the Army High Command, OKH, early in June 1940, just before the assault on Dunkirk, and for the first 18 months of the Russian campaign spent most of his time in Soviet territory, where, among other things, he helped organize the Russian volunteer units from among the prisoners of war. By this time, according to his friends, Stauffenberg believed that while the Germans were getting rid of Hitler's tyranny, these Russian troops could be used to overthrow Stalin's. Perhaps this was an instance of the influence of Stefan George's woolly ideas. The brutality of the SS in Russia, not to mention Hitler's order to shoot the Bolshevik commissars, opened Stauffenberg's eyes as to the master he was serving. As chance had it, he met in Russia two of the chief conspirators who had decided to make an end to that master, General von Treskow and Schlabrendorf. The latter says it took only a few subsequent meetings to convince them that Stauffenberg was their man. He became an active conspirator. But he was still only a junior officer, and he soon saw that the field marshals were too confused, if not too cowardly, to do anything to remove Hitler or to stop the grisly slaughter of Jews, Russians, and POWs behind the lines. Also, the needless disaster at Stalingrad sickened him. As soon as it was over, in February 1943, he asked to be sent to the front and was posted as operations officer of the 10th Panzer Division in Tunisia, joining it in the last days of the Battle of the Kasserine Pass, in which his unit had thrown the Americans out of the gap. On April 7th, his car drove into a minefield, some say it was also attacked by low-flying Allied aircraft, and Stauffenberg was gravely wounded. He lost his left eye, his right hand, and two fingers of the other hand, and suffered injuries to his left ear and knee. For several weeks it seemed probable that he would be left totally blind if he survived. But under the expert supervision at a Munich hospital of Professor Sauerbruch, he was restored to life. Almost any other man, one would think, would have retired from the army and thus from the conspiracy. But by midsummer he was writing General Ulbricht, after much practice in wielding a pen with the three fingers of his bandaged left hand, that he expected to return to active duty within 3 months. During the long convalescence he had had time to reflect, and he had come to the conclusion that, physically handicapped though he was, he had a sacred mission to perform. "I feel I must do something now to save Germany," he told his wife, the Countess Nina, mother of his four young children, when she visited his bedside one day. "We general staff officers must all accept our share of the responsibility." By the end of September 1943, he was back in Berlin as a lieutenant colonel and chief of staff to General Olbricht at the General Army Office. Soon he was practicing with a pair of tongs how to set off one of the English-made Abwehr bombs with the three fingers of his good hand. He was doing much more. His dynamic personality, the clarity of his mind, the catholicity of his ideas, and his marked talents as an organizer infused new life and determination into the conspirators. And also some differences, for Stauffenberg was not satisfied with the kind of stodgy, conservative, colorless regime which the old, rusty leaders of the conspiracy, Beck, Goerdeler, and Hassel, envisaged as soon as National Socialism was overthrown. More practical than his friends in the Kreisau circle, he wanted a new dynamic social democracy, and he insisted that the proposed anti-Nazi cabinet include his new friend Julius Leber, a brilliant socialist, and Wilhelm Leuschner, a former trade union official, both deep and active in the conspiracy. There was much argument, but Stauffenberg rapidly achieved dominance over the political leaders of the plot. He was equally successful with most of the military men. He recognized General Beck as the nominal leader of these and held the former General Staff Chief in great admiration, but on returning to Berlin he saw that Beck, recovering from a major cancer operation, was only a shell of his former self, tired and somewhat dispirited, and that, moreover, he had no concept of politics, being in this field completely under the spell of Goerdeler. Beck's illustrious name in military circles would be useful, even necessary, in carrying out the putsch. But for active help in supplying and commanding the troops which would be needed, younger officers who were on active duty had to be mobilized. Stauffenberg soon had most of the key men he needed. These were, besides Olbricht, his chief, General Stief, head of the organization branch of OKH, General Eduard Wagner, the first quartermaster general of the army, General Erich Fellgiebel, the chief of signals at OKW, General Fritz Lindemann, head of the ordnance office, General Paul von Hasse, chief of the Berlin Kommandantur, who could furnish the troops for taking over Berlin, and Colonel Freiherr von Röhne, head of the Foreign Armies section, with his chief of staff, Captain Count von Matuschka. There were two or three key generals, chief of whom was Fritz Fromm, the actual commander-in-chief of the replacement army, who, like Kluge, blew hot and cold and could not be definitely counted on. The plotters also did not yet have a field marshal on active duty. Field Marshal von Witzleben, one of the original conspirators, was slated to become commander-in-chief of the armed forces, but he was on the inactive list and had no troops at his command. Field Marshal von Rundstedt, who now commanded all troops in the West, was approached, but declined to go back on his oath to the Führer, or such at least was his explanation. Likewise, the brilliant but opportunistic Field Marshal von Manstein. At this juncture, early in 1944, a very active and popular field marshal made himself, at first without the knowledge of Stauffenberg, somewhat available to the conspirators. This was Rommel, and his entrance into the plot against Hitler came as a great surprise to the resistance leaders, and was not approved by most of them, who regarded the Desert Fox as a Nazi and as an opportunist, who had blatantly courted Hitler's favor and was only now deserting him because he knew the war was lost. In January 1944, Rommel had become commander of Army Group B in the West, the main force with which the expected Anglo-American invasion across the Channel was to be repelled. In France, he began to see a good deal of two old friends, General Alexander von Falkenhausen, the military governor of Belgium and northern France, and General Karl Heinrich von Stulpnagel, military governor of France. Both generals had already joined the anti-Hitler conspiracy and gradually initiated Rommel into it. They were aided by an old civilian friend of Rommel, Dr. Karl Strühlen, the Oberbürgermeister of Stuttgart, who, like so many other characters in this narrative, had been an enthusiastic Nazi and now, with defeat looming and the cities of Germany, including his own, rapidly becoming rubble from the Allied bombing, was having second thoughts. He, in turn, had been helped along this path by Dr. Goerdeler, who, in August 1943, had persuaded him to join in drawing up a memorandum to the Ministry of the Interior, now headed by Himmler, in which they jointly demanded a cessation of the persecution of the Jews and the Christian churches, the restoration of civil rights, and the re-establishment of a system of justice divorced from the party and the SS Gestapo. Through Frau Rommel, Strulen brought the memorandum to the attention of the Field Marshal, on whom it appears to have had a marked effect. Toward the end of February 1944, the two men met at Rommel's home at Herlingen, near Ulm, and had a heart-to-heart talk. "I told him," the mayor later recounted, "that certain senior officers of the army in the East proposed to make Hitler a prisoner and to force him to announce over the radio that he had abdicated. Rommel approved of the idea. I went on to say to him that he was our greatest and most popular general, and more respected abroad than any other. 'You are the only one,' I said, 'who can prevent civil war in Germany. You must lend your name to the movement.' Rommel hesitated and finally made his decision. 'I believe,' he said to Strulen, 'it is my duty to come to the rescue of Germany.'" At this meeting, and at all subsequent ones which Rommel had with the plotters, he opposed assassinating Hitler, not on moral but on practical grounds. To kill the dictator, he argued, would be to make a martyr of him. He insisted that Hitler be arrested by the army and haled before a German court for crimes against his own people and those of the occupied lands. At this time, fate brought another influence on Rommel in the person of General Hans Speidel, who, on April 15, 1944, became the Field Marshal's chief of staff. Speidel, like his fellow conspirator Stauffenberg, though they belonged to quite separate groups, was an unusual army officer. He was not only a soldier, but a philosopher, having received summa cum laude, a doctorate in philosophy, from the University of Tübingen in 1925. He lost no time in going to work on his chief. Within a month, on May 15th, he arranged a meeting at a country house near Paris between Rommel, Stupnagel, and their chiefs of staff. The purpose, says Speidel, was to work out the necessary measures for ending the war in the West and overthrowing the Nazi regime. This was a large order, and Speidel realized that in preparing it, closer contacts with the anti-Nazis in the homeland, especially with the Goerdeler-Beck group, were urgently necessary. For some weeks, the mercurial Goerdeler had been pressing for a secret meeting between Rommel and, of all people, Neurath, who, having done his own share of Hitler's dirty work, first as foreign minister and then as the Reich protector of Bohemia, was also experiencing a rude awakening now that terrible disaster was about to overtake the fatherland. It was decided that it would be too dangerous for Rommel to meet with Neurath and Strulen, so the field marshal sent General Speidel, at whose home in Freudenstadt the conference was held on May 27th. The three men present, Speidel, Neurath, and Strulen, were, like Rommel himself, all Swabians, and this affinity appears not only to have made the meeting congenial, but to have led to ready agreement. This was that Hitler must be quickly overthrown and that Rommel must be prepared to become either the interim head of state or commander-in-chief of the armed forces, neither of which posts, it must be said, Rommel at any time ever demanded for himself. A number of details were worked out, including plans for contacting the Western Allies for an armistice, and a code for communication between the conspirators in Germany and Rommel's headquarters. General Speidel is emphatic in his assertion not only that Rommel frankly informed his immediate superior in the West, Field Marshal von Rundstedt, as to what was up, but that the latter was in complete agreement. There was a flaw, however, in the character of this senior officer of the army. During a discussion on the formulation of joint demands to Hitler, Speidel later wrote, Rundstedt said to Rommel, "You are young. You know and love the people. You do it." After further conferences that late spring, the following plan was drawn up. Speidel, almost alone among the army conspirators in the West, survived to describe it. An immediate armistice with the Western Allies, but not unconditional surrender. German withdrawal in the West to Germany. Immediate suspension of the Allied bombing of Germany. Arrest of Hitler for trial before a German court. Overthrow of Nazi rule. Temporary assumption of executive power in Germany by the resistance forces of all classes under the leadership of General Beck, Goerdeler, and the trade union representative, Leuschner. No military dictatorship. Preparation of a constructive peace within the framework of a United States of Europe. In the East, continuation of the war. Holding a shortened line between the mouth of the Danube, the Carpathian Mountains, the River Vistula, and Memel. The generals seem to have had no doubts whatsoever that the British and American armies would then join them in the war against Russia to prevent, as they said, Europe from becoming Bolshevik. In Berlin, General Beck agreed, at least to the extent of continuing the war in the East. Early in May, he sent through Gasevius a memorandum to Dulles in Switzerland, outlining a fantastic plan. The German generals in the West were to withdraw their forces to the German frontier after the Anglo-American invasion. While this was going on, Beck urged that the Western Allies carry out three tactical operations. Land three airborne divisions in the Berlin area to help the conspirators hold the capital. Carry out large-scale seaborne landings on the German coast near Hamburg and Bremen. And land a sizable force across the Channel in France. Reliable anti-Nazi German troops would in the meantime take over in the Munich area and surround Hitler at his mountain retreat on the Obersalzberg. The war against Russia would go on. Dulles says he lost no time in trying to bring the Berlin conspirators down to earth. They were told there could be no separate peace with the West. Stauffenberg, his friends in the Kreisau circle, and such members of the conspiracy as Schulenburg, the former ambassador in Moscow, had come to realize this. In fact, most of them, including Stauffenberg, were Easterners, pro-Russian though anti-Bolshevik. For a time, they believed that it might be easier to get a better peace with Russia, which through statements from Stalin himself had emphasized in its radio propaganda that it was fighting not against the German people but against the Hitlerites, than with the Western Allies, who harped only of unconditional surrender. At their meeting at Casablanca, Churchill and Roosevelt had issued on January 24, 1943, their declaration of unconditional surrender for Germany. Goebbels naturally made a great deal of this in trying to whip the German people into a state of all-out resistance, but in the opinion of this author, his success has been grossly exaggerated by a surprisingly large number of Western writers. But they abandoned such wishful thinking in October 1943 when the Soviet government at the Moscow Conference of Allied Foreign Ministers formally adhered to the Casablanca Declaration of Unconditional Surrender. And now, as the fateful summer of 1944 approached, they realized that with the Red Armies nearing the frontier of the Reich, the British and American armies poised for a large-scale invasion across the Channel, and the German resistance to Alexander's Allied forces in Italy crumbling, they must quickly get rid of Hitler and the Nazi regime if any kind of peace at all was to be had that would spare Germany from being overrun and annihilated. In Berlin, Stauffenberg and his confederates had at last perfected their plans. They were lumped under the codename Valkyrie, an appropriate term, since the Valkyrie were the maidens in Norse-German mythology, beautiful but terrifying, who were supposed to have hovered over the ancient battlefields, choosing those who would be slain. In this case, Adolf Hitler was to be slain. Ironically enough, Admiral Canaris, before his fall, had sold the Führer the idea of Valkyrie, dressing it up as a plan for the Home Army to take over the security of Berlin and the other large cities in case of a revolt of the millions of foreign laborers toiling in these centers. Such a revolt was highly unlikely, indeed impossible, since the foreign workers were unarmed and unorganized. But to the suspicious Führer, danger lurked everywhere these days, and with almost all the able-bodied soldiers absent from the homeland either at the front or keeping down the populace in the far-flung occupied areas, he readily fell in with the idea that the Home Army ought to have plans for protecting the internal security of the Reich against the hordes of sullen slave laborers. Thus, Valkyrie became a perfect cover for the military conspirators, enabling them to draw up quite openly plans for the Home Army to take over the capital and such cities as Vienna, Munich, and Cologne as soon as Hitler had been assassinated. In Berlin, their main difficulty was that they had very few troops at their disposal, and that these were outnumbered by the SS formations. Also, there were considerable numbers of Luftwaffe units in and around the city manning the anti-aircraft defenses, and these troops, unless the army moved swiftly, would remain loyal to Göring and certainly make a fight of it to retain the Nazi regime under their chief, even if Hitler were dead. Their flak guns could be used as artillery against the army detachments. On the other hand, the police force in Berlin had been won over through its chief, Count von Heldorf, who had joined the conspiracy. In view of the strength of the SS and Air Force troops, Stauffenberg laid great stress on the timing of the operation to gain control of the capital. The first 2 hours would be the most critical. In that short space of time, the army troops must occupy and secure the national broadcasting headquarters and the city's two radio stations, the telegraph and telephone centrals, the Reich Chancellery, the ministries, and the headquarters of the SS Gestapo. Goebbels, the only prominent Nazi who rarely left Berlin, must be arrested along with the SS officers. In the meantime, the moment Hitler was killed, his headquarters at Rostenburg must be isolated from Germany so that neither Goering nor Himmler, nor any of the Nazi generals such as Keitel and Jodl, could take over and attempt to rally the police or the troops behind a continued Nazi regime. General Feldgebel, chief of signals who was stationed at the Führer's headquarters, had undertaken to see to this. Only then, after all these things had been accomplished within the first couple of hours of the coup, could the messages, which had been drawn up and filed, be sent out by radio, telephone, and telegraph to the commanders of the Home Army in other cities, and to the top generals commanding the troops at the front and in the occupied zones, announcing that Hitler was dead and that a new anti-Nazi government had been formed in Berlin. The revolt would have to be over, and achieved, within 24 hours, and the new government firmly installed. Otherwise, the vacillating generals might have second thoughts. Goering and Himmler might be able to rally them, and a civil war would ensue. In that case, the fronts would cave in, and the very chaos and collapse which the plotters wished to prevent would become inevitable. All depended for success, after Hitler had been assassinated, and Stauffenberg personally would see to this, on the ability of the plotters to utilize for their purposes, and with the utmost speed and energy, the available army troops in and around Berlin. This posed a knotty problem. Only General Fritz Fromm, the commander-in-chief of the Home or Replacement Army, could normally give the order to carry out Valkyrie, and to the very last he remained a question mark. All through 1943 the conspirators had worked on him. They finally concluded that this wary officer could be definitely counted upon only after he saw that the revolt had succeeded. But since they were sure of its success, they proceeded to draft a series of orders under Fromm's name, though without his knowledge. In case he wavered at the crucial moment, Fromm was to be replaced by General Hoeppner, the brilliant tank commander who had been cashiered by Hitler after the battle for Moscow in 1941 and forbidden to wear his uniform. The problem of another key general in Berlin also plagued the plotters. This was General von Kurzfleisch, an out-and-out Nazi, who commanded Wehrkreis III, which included Berlin and Brandenburg. It was decided to have him arrested and replaced by General Freiherr von Thüngen. General Paul von Hase, the commandant of Berlin, was in on the plot and could be counted upon to lead the local garrison troops in the first all-important step of taking over the city. Besides drawing up detailed plans for seizing control of Berlin, Stauffenberg and Tresco, in collaboration with Gerdler, Beck, Witzleben, and others, drafted papers giving instructions to the district military commanders on how they were to take over executive power in their areas, put down the SS, arrest the leading Nazis, and occupy the concentration camps. Furthermore, several ringing declarations were composed, which at the appropriate moment were to be issued to the armed forces, the German people, the press, and the radio. Some were signed by Beck as the new head of state, others by Field Marshal von Witzleben as commander-in-chief of the Wehrmacht, and by Gerdler as the new chancellor. Copies of the orders and appeals were typed in great secrecy late at night in the Bendlerstrasse by two brave women in the plot, Frau Erika von Tresco, the wife of the general who had done so much to further the conspiracy, and Margarete von Ofen, the daughter of a retired general and for years the faithful secretary of two former commanders-in-chief of the army, Generals von Hammerstein and von Fritsch. The papers were then hidden in General Olbricht's safe. The plans, then, were ready. In fact, they had been perfected by the end of 1943, but for months little had been done to carry them out. Events, however, could not wait on the conspirators. As June 1944 came, they realized that time was running out on them. For one thing, the Gestapo was closing in. The arrests of those who were in on the plot, among them Count von Moltke and the members of the Kreisau Circle, were mounting with each week that passed, and there were many executions. Beck, Girdler, Hassel, Witzleben, and others in the inner circle were being so closely shadowed by Himmler's secret police that they found it increasingly difficult to meet together. Himmler himself had warned the fallen Canaris in the spring that he knew very well that a rebellion was being hatched by the generals and their civilian friends. He mentioned that he was keeping a watch on Beck and Girdler. Canaris passed the warning on to Olbricht. Just as ominous for the conspirators was the military situation. The Russians, it was believed, were about to launch an all-out offensive in the east. Rome was being abandoned to the Allied forces. It fell on June 4th. In the west, the Anglo-American invasion was imminent. Very soon, Germany might go down to military defeat, before Nazism could be overthrown. Indeed, there was a growing number of conspirators, perhaps influenced by the thinking of the Kreisau Circle, who began to feel that it might be better to call off their plans and let Hitler and the Nazis take the responsibility for the catastrophe. To overthrow them now might merely perpetrate another stab-in-the-back legend, such as that which had fooled so many Germans after the First World War. The Anglo-American Invasion, June 6, 1944. Stauffenberg himself did not believe that the Western Allies would attempt to land in France that summer. He persisted in this belief even after Colonel Georg Hansen, a carryover from the Abwehr in Himmler's Military Intelligence Bureau, had warned him early in May that the invasion might begin on any day in June. The German army itself was beset by doubts, at least as to the date and place of the assault. In May, there had been 18 days when the weather, the sea, and the tides were just right for a landing, and the Germans noted that General Eisenhower had not taken advantage of them. On May 30th, Rundstedt, the commander-in-chief in the West, had reported to Hitler that there was no indication that the invasion was immediately imminent. On June 4th, the Air Force meteorologist in Paris advised that because of the inclement weather, no Allied action could be expected for at least a fortnight. On the strength of this and of what little information he had, the Luftwaffe had been prevented from making aerial reconnaissance of the harbors on England's south coast, where Eisenhower's troops at that moment were swarming aboard their ships, and the Navy had withdrawn its reconnaissance craft from the channel because of the heavy seas. Rommel drew up a situation report on the morning of June 5th, reporting to Rundstedt that the invasion was not imminent, and immediately set off by car for his home at Herlingen to spend the night with his family and then to proceed to Berchtesgaden the next day to confer with Hitler. June 5th, General Speidel, Rommel's chief of staff, later recalled, was a quiet day. There seemed no reason why Rommel should not make his somewhat leisurely journey back to Germany. There were the usual reports from German agents about the possibility of an Allied landing, this time between June 6th and June 16th. But there had been hundreds of these since April, and they were not taken seriously. Indeed, on the 6th, General Friedrich Dollmann, who commanded the 7th Army in Normandy, on whose beaches the Allied forces were about to land, ordered a temporary relaxation of the standing alert and convoked his senior officers for a map exercise at Rennes, some 125 miles south of those beaches. If the Germans were in the dark about the date of the invasion, they were also ignorant of where it would take place. Rundstedt and Rommel were certain it would be in the Pas-de-Calais area, where the channel was at its narrowest. There they had concentrated their strongest force, the 15th Army, whose strength during the spring was increased from 10 to 15 infantry divisions. But by the end of March, Adolf Hitler's uncanny intuition was telling him that the Schwerpunkt of the invasion probably would be in Normandy. And during the next few weeks, he ordered considerable reinforcements to the region between the Seine and the Loire. "Watch Normandy," he kept warning his generals. Still, the overwhelming part of German strength, in both infantry and panzer divisions, was retained north of the Seine, between Le Havre and Dunkirk. Rundstedt and his generals were watching the Pas-de-Calais rather than Normandy, and they were encouraged in this by a number of deceptive maneuvers carried out during April and May by the British-American High Command, which indicated to them that their calculations were correct. The day of June 5th, then, passed in relative quiet, so far as the Germans were concerned. Severe Anglo-American air attacks continued to disrupt German depots, radar stations, V-1 sites, communications, and transport, but these had been going on night and day for weeks and seemed no more intense on this day than on others. Shortly after dark, Rundstedt's headquarters was informed that the BBC in London was broadcasting an unusually large number of coded messages to the French resistance, and that the German radar stations between Cherbourg and Le Havre were being jammed. At 10 p.m., the 15th Army intercepted a code message from the BBC to the French resistance, which it believed meant that the invasion was about to begin. This army was alerted, but Rundstedt did not think it necessary to alert the 7th Army, on whose sector of the coast farther west, between Caen and Cherbourg, the Allied forces were now, toward midnight, approaching on 1,000 ships. It was not until 11 minutes past 1 a.m. June 6th that the 7th Army, its commander not yet returned from his map exercise at Rennes, realized what was happening. Two American and one British airborne divisions had begun landing in its midst. The general alarm was sounded at 1:30 a.m. 45 minutes later, Major General Max Pemsel, Chief of Staff of the 7th Army, got General Speidel on the telephone at Rommel's headquarters and told him that it looked like a large-scale operation. Speidel did not believe it, but passed on the report to Rundstedt, who was equally skeptical. Both generals believed the dropping of parachutists was merely an Allied feint to cover their main landings around Calais. At 2:40 a.m., Pemsel was advised that Rundstedt does not consider this to be a major operation. Not even when the news began to reach him shortly after dawn on June 6th that on the Normandy coast between the rivers Vire and Orne, a huge Allied fleet was disembarking large bodies of troops, under cover of a murderous fire from the big guns of an armada of warships, did the Commander-in-Chief West believe that this was to be the main Allied assault. It did not become apparent, Speidel says, until the afternoon of June 6th. By that time, the Americans had a toehold on two beaches, and the British on a third, and had penetrated inland for a distance of from 2 to 6 miles. Speidel had telephoned Rommel at 6 a.m. at his home, and the field marshal had rushed back by car without going on to see Hitler, but he did not arrive at Army Group B headquarters until late that afternoon. Because of Allied air superiority in the West, Hitler had forbidden his senior commanders to travel by plane. In the meantime, Speidel, Rundstedt, and the latter's chief of staff, General Blumentritt, had been on the telephone to OKW, which was then at Berchtesgaden. Due to an idiotic order of Hitler's, not even the commander-in-chief in the West could employ his panzer divisions without the specific permission of the Führer. When the three generals, early on the morning of the 6th, begged for permission to rush two tank divisions to Normandy, Jodl replied that Hitler wanted first to see what developed, whereupon the Führer went to bed, and could not be disturbed by the frantic calls of the generals in the West until 3 p.m. When he woke up, the bad news, which had in the meantime arrived, finally stirred the Nazi warlord to action. He gave, too late as it turned out, permission to engage the Panzerlehr and 12th SS Panzer Divisions in Normandy. He also issued a famous order which has been preserved for posterity in the log of the 7th Army. 16:55 hours, June 6, 1944. Chief of Staff Western Command emphasizes the desire of the Supreme Command to have the enemy in the bridgehead annihilated by the evening of June 6th, since there exists the danger of additional sea and airborne landings for support. The beachhead must be cleaned up by not later than tonight. In the eerie mountain air of the Obersalzberg, from which Hitler was now trying to direct the most crucial battle of the war up to this moment, he had been saying for months that Germany's destiny would be decided in the West, this fantastic order seems to have been issued in all seriousness, concurred in by Jodl and Keitel. Even Rommel, who passed it on by telephone shortly before 5 o'clock that afternoon, an hour after his return from Germany, seems to have taken it seriously, for he ordered 7th Army headquarters to launch an attack by the 21st Panzer Division, the only German armored unit in the area, immediately, regardless of whether reinforcements arrive or not. This the division had already done, without waiting for Rommel's command. General Pemsel, who was on the other end of the line when Rommel called 7th Army headquarters, gave a blunt reply to Hitler's demand that the Allied beachhead, there were actually now three, be cleaned up by not later than tonight. That, he replied, would be impossible. Hitler's much-propagandized Atlantic Wall had been breached within a few hours. The once vaunted Luftwaffe had been driven completely from the air, and the German navy from the sea, and the army taken by surprise. The battle was far from over, but its outcome was not long in doubt. From June 9th on, says Speidel, the initiative lay with the Allies. Rundstedt and Rommel decided that it was time to say so to Hitler, face to face, and to demand that he accept the consequences. They enticed him to a meeting on June 17th at Margival, north of Soissons, in the elaborate bomb-proof bunker which had been built to serve as the Führer's headquarters for the invasion of Britain in the summer of 1940, but never used. Now, 4 summers later, the Nazi warlord appeared there for the first time. He looked pale and sleepless, Speidel later wrote, playing nervously with his glasses and an array of colored pencils which he held between his fingers. He sat hunched upon a stool while the field marshals stood. His hypnotic powers seemed to have waned. There was a curt and frosty greeting from him. Then, in a loud voice, he spoke bitterly of his displeasure at the success of the Allied landings, for which he tried to hold the field commanders responsible. But the prospect of another stunning defeat was emboldening the generals, or at least Rommel, whom Rundstedt left to do most of the talking, when Hitler's diatribe against them had come to a momentary pause. With merciless frankness, says Speidel, who was present, Rommel pointed out that the struggle was hopeless against the Allied superiority in the air, at sea, and on the land. If, in spite of the enemy's air superiority, we succeed in getting a large part of our mobile force into action in the threatened coast defense sectors in the first hours, I am convinced that the enemy attack on the coast will collapse completely on its first day, Rommel had written General Jodl on April 23rd, less than 2 months before. The Rommel Papers, edited by Little Hart, page 468. Hitler's strict orders had made it impossible to throw in the armored divisions in the first hours or even the first days. When they finally arrived, they were thrown in piecemeal and failed. Well, not quite hopeless, if Hitler abandoned his absurd determination to hold every foot of ground and then to drive the Allied forces into the sea. Rommel proposed, with Rundstedt's assent, that the Germans withdraw out of range of the enemy's murderous naval guns, take their panzer units out of the line and reform them for a later thrust which might defeat the Allies in a battle fought outside the range of the enemy's naval artillery. But the Supreme Warlord would not listen to any proposal for withdrawal. German soldiers must stand and fight. The subject obviously was unpleasant to him, and he quickly changed to others. In a display which Speidel calls a strange mixture of cynicism and false intuition, Hitler assured the generals that the new V-1 weapon, the buzz bomb, which had been launched for the first time the day before against London, would be decisive against Great Britain and make the British willing to make peace. When the two field marshals drew Hitler's attention to the utter failure of the Luftwaffe in the West, the Führer retorted that masses of jet fighters, the Allies had no jets, but the Germans had just put them into production, would soon drive the British and American flyers from the skies. Then, he said, Britain would collapse. At this juncture, the approach of Allied planes forced them to adjourn to the Führer's air raid shelter. Safe in the underground concrete bunker, they resumed the conversation. The talks lasted from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., with a break for lunch, a one-dish meal, Speidel recounts, at which Hitler bolted a heaped plate of rice and vegetables after it had been previously tasted for him. Pills and liqueur glasses containing various medicines were ranged around his place, and he took them in turn. 2 SS men stood guard behind his chair. And at this point, Rommel insisted on steering it into politics. He predicted, says Speidel, that the German front in Normandy would collapse and that a breakthrough into Germany by the Allies could not be checked. He doubted whether the Russian front could be held. He pointed to Germany's complete political isolation. He concluded with an urgent request that the war be brought to an end. Hitler, who had interrupted Rommel several times, finally cut him short. Don't you worry about the future course of the war, but rather about your own invasion front. The two field marshals were getting nowhere, either with their military or political arguments. Hitler paid no attention whatsoever to their warnings, General Jodl later recalled at Nuremberg. Finally, the generals urged the Supreme Commander at least to visit Rommel's Army Group B headquarters to confer with some of the field commanders on what they were up against in Normandy. Hitler reluctantly agreed to the visit for June 19th, 2 days hence. He never showed up. Shortly after the field marshals had departed from Marjival on the afternoon of June 17th, an errant V-1 on its way to London turned around and landed on top of the Führer's bunker. No one was killed or even hurt, but Hitler was so upset that he set off immediately for safer parts, not stopping until he got to the mountains of Berchtesgaden. There, more bad news shortly arrived. On June 20th, the long-awaited Russian offensive on the Central Front began, developing with such overwhelming power that within a few days the German Army Group Center, in which Hitler had concentrated his strongest forces, was completely smashed, the front torn wide open, and the road to Poland opened. On July 4th, the Russians crossed the 1939 Polish eastern border and converged on East Prussia. All available reserves of the High Command were quickly rounded up to be rushed, for the first time in World War II, to the defense of the Fatherland itself. This helped to doom the German armies in the West. From now on, they could not count on receiving any sizable reinforcements. Once more, on June 29th, Rundstedt and Rommel appealed to Hitler to face realities, both in the East and in the West, and to try to end the war while considerable parts of the German army were still in being. This meeting took place on the Obersalzberg, where the Supreme Warlord treated the two field marshals frostily, dismissing their appeals curtly and then lapsing into a long monologue on how he would win the war with new miracle weapons. His discourse, says Speidel, became lost in fantastic digressions. 2 days later, Rundstedt was replaced as Commander-in-Chief West by Field Marshal von Kluge. Rundstedt's dismissal may have come partly as the result of his blunt words to Keitel the night before. The latter had rung him up to inquire about the situation. An all-out German attack on the British lines by four SS panzer divisions had just floundered, and Rundstedt was in a gloomy mood. "What shall we do?" cried Keitel. "Make peace, you fools," Rundstedt retorted. "What else can you do?" It seems that Keitel, the telltale toady, as most army field commanders called him, went straight to Hitler with the remarks. The Führer was at that moment conferring with Kluge, who had been on sick leave for the last few months as the result of injuries sustained in a motor accident. Kluge was immediately named to replace Rundstedt. In such ways were top commands changed by the Nazi warlord. General Blumentritt told of the telephone conversation to both Wilmot, The Struggle for Europe, page 347, and Little Hart, The German General's Talk, page 205. On July 15th, Rommel wrote a long letter to Hitler and dispatched it by army teletype. "The troops," he wrote, "are fighting heroically everywhere, but the unequal struggle is nearing its end." He added a postscript in his own handwriting. "I must beg you to draw the proper conclusions without delay. I feel it my duty as Commander-in-Chief of the Army Group to state this clearly." "I have given him his last chance," Rommel told Speidel. "If he does not take it, we will act." 2 days later, on the afternoon of July 17th, while driving back to headquarters from the Normandy front, Rommel's staff car was shot up by low-flying Allied fighter planes, and he was so critically wounded that it was first thought he would not survive the day. This was a disaster to the conspirators, for Rommel had now, Speidel swears to it, made up his mind irrevocably to do his part in ridding Germany of Hitler's rule, though still opposing his assassination, within the next few days. As it turned out, his dash and daring were sorely missing among the army officers who, at long last, as the German armies crumbled in the east and west that July of 1944, made their final bid to bring Hitler and National Socialism down. The conspirators, says Speidel, felt themselves painfully deprived of their pillar of strength. Speidel quotes the writer Ernst Jünger, whose books had once been popular in Nazi Germany but who eventually had turned and had joined the Paris end of the plot. "The blow that felled Rommel on the Livarot Road on July 17th deprived our plan of the only man strong enough to bear the terrible weight of war and civil war simultaneously." Speidel, Invasion 1944, page 119. The Conspiracy at the 11th Hour. The successful Allied landing in Normandy threw the conspirators in Berlin into great confusion. Stauffenberg, as we have seen, had not believed it would be attempted in 1944, and that if it were, there was a 50-50 chance that it would fail. He seems to have wished that it would, since then the American and British governments, after such a bloody and costly setback, would be more willing to negotiate a peace in the West with his new anti-Nazi government, which in this case could get better terms. when it became evident that the invasion had succeeded, that Germany had suffered another crucial defeat, and that a new one was threatening in the east, Stauffenberg, Beck, and Girdler wondered whether there was any point in going ahead with their plans. If they succeeded, they would only be blamed for bringing on the final catastrophe. Though they knew it was now inevitable, this was not generally realized by the mass of the German people. Beck finally concluded that though a successful anti-Nazi revolt could not now spare Germany from enemy occupation, it could bring the war to an end and save further loss of blood and destruction of the fatherland. A peace now would also prevent the Russians from overrunning Germany and Bolshevizing it. It would show the world that there was another Germany besides the Nazi one. And, who knew, perhaps at least the Western Allies, despite their terms of unconditional surrender, might not be too hard on a conquered Germany. Girdler agreed and pinned even greater hopes on the Western democracies. He knew, he said, how much Churchill feared the danger of a total Russian victory. The younger men, led by Stauffenberg, were not entirely convinced. They sought advice from Tresco, who was now chief of staff of the Second Army on the crumbling Russian front. His reply brought the stumbling plotters back on the track. The assassination must be attempted at any cost. Even should it fail, the attempt to seize power in the capital must be undertaken. We must prove to the world and to future generations that the men of the German resistance movement dared to take the decisive step and to hazard their lives upon it. Compared with this object, nothing else matters. This inspired answer settled the matter and revived the spirits and dissolved the doubts of Stauffenberg and his young friends. The threatened collapse of the fronts in Russia, France, and Italy impelled the plotters to act at once. Another event helped to speed them on their way. From the beginning, the Beck-Girdler-Hassel circle had declined to have anything to do with the communist underground, and vice versa. To the communists, the plotters were as reactionary as the Nazis, and their very success might prevent a communist Germany from succeeding a National Socialist one. Beck and his friends were well aware of this communist line, and they knew also that the communist underground was directed from Moscow and served chiefly as an espionage source for the Russians. Furthermore, they knew that it had become infiltrated with Gestapo agents. V-men, as Heinrich Müller, the Gestapo chief and himself a student and admirer of the Soviet NKVD, called them. This came out in the Rote Kapelle affair in 1942, when the Abwehr discovered a large number of strategically placed Germans, many of them from old prominent families, running an extensive espionage network for the Russians. At one time, they were transmitting intelligence to Moscow over some 100 clandestine radio transmitters in Germany and in the occupied countries of the West. The leader of the Rote Kapelle, Red Orchestra, was Harald Schulze-Boysen, a grandson of Grand Admiral von Tirpitz, a picturesque leader of the Lost Generation after the First World War, and a familiar bohemian figure in those days in Berlin, where his black sweater, his thick mane of blonde hair, and his passion for revolutionary poetry and politics attracted attention. At that time, he rejected both Nazism and communism, though he considered himself a man of the left. Through his mother, he got into the Luftwaffe as a lieutenant at the outbreak of the war and wormed himself into Goering's research office, the Forschungsamt, which, as we have seen in connection with the Anschluss, specialized in tapping telephones. Soon he was organizing a vast espionage service for Moscow, with trusted associates in every ministry and military office in Berlin. Among these were Arvid Harnack, nephew of a famous theologian, a brilliant young economist in the Ministry of Economics, who was married to an American woman, Mildred Fish, whom he had met at the University of Wisconsin, Franz Schellaha in the Foreign Office, Horst Heilmann in the Propaganda Ministry, and Countess Erika von Brockdorff in the Ministry of Labor. Two Soviet agents who parachuted into Germany and were later apprehended gave the Rote Kapelle away, and a large number of arrests followed. Of the 75 leaders charged with treason, 50 were condemned to death, including Schulze-Boysen and Harnack. Mildred Harnack and Countess von Brockdorff got off with prison sentences, but Hitler insisted that they be executed too, and they were. To impress would-be traitors, the Führer ordered that the condemned be hanged. But there were no gallows in Berlin, where the traditional form of execution was the axe, and so the victims were simply strangled by a rope around their necks, which was attached to a meat hook, borrowed from an abattoir, and slowly hoisted. From then on, this method of hanging was to be employed as a special form of cruelty on those who dared to defy the Führer. In June, the plotters, against the advice of Gerdler and the older members, decided to contact the communists. This was at the suggestion of the socialist wing, and especially of Adolf Reichwein, the socialist philosopher and celebrated Wandervogel, who was now director of the Folklore Museum in Berlin. Reichwein had maintained vague contacts with the communists. Though Stauffenberg himself was suspicious of them, his socialist friends, Reichwein and Labour, convinced him that some contact with them had become necessary in order to see what they were up to and what they would do in case the putsch succeeded, and if possible, to use them at the last moment to widen the basis of the anti-Nazi resistance. Reluctantly, he agreed to Labour and Reichwein meeting with the underground communist leaders on June 22nd, but he warned them that the communists should be told as little as possible. The meeting took place in East Berlin between Labour and Reichwein, representing the socialists, and two individuals named Franz Jakob and Anton Sefko, who claimed to be, and perhaps were, the leaders of the communist underground. They were accompanied by a third comrade whom they introduced as Rambo. The communists turned out to know quite a bit about the plot against Hitler and wanted to know more. They asked for a meeting with its military leaders on July 4th. Stauffenberg refused, but Reichwein was authorized to represent him at a further meeting on that date. When he arrived at it, he, along with Jakob and Sefko, were promptly arrested. Rambo, it turned out, was a Gestapo stool pigeon. The next day, Labour, on whom Stauffenberg was counting to become the dominant political force in the new government, was also arrested. All four, Labour, Reichwein, Jakob, and Sefko, were executed. Stauffenberg was not only deeply upset by the arrest of Labour, with whom he had become a close personal friend and whom he regarded as indispensable to the proposed new government, but he saw at once that the whole conspiracy was in dire peril of being snuffed out now that Himmler's men were so close on its trail. Labour and Reichwein were courageous men and could be counted on, he thought, not to reveal any secrets, even under torture. Or could they be? Some of the plotters were not so sure. There might be limits beyond which even the bravest man could not keep silent when his body was being racked by insufferable pain. The arrest of Labour and Reichwein was a further spur to immediate action. The coup of July 20, 1944. Toward the end of June, the plotters received one good stroke of fortune. Stauffenberg was promoted to full colonel and appointed chief of staff to General Fromm, the commander-in-chief of the Home Army. This post not only enabled him to issue orders to the Home Army under Fromm's name, but gave him direct and frequent access to Hitler. Indeed, the Führer began to summon the chief of the replacement army, or his deputy, to headquarters two or three times a week to demand fresh replacements for his decimated divisions in Russia. At one of these meetings, Stauffenberg intended to plant his bomb. Stauffenberg had now become the key man in the conspiracy. On his shoulders alone rested its only chance for success. As the one member of the plot who could penetrate the heavily guarded Führer headquarters, it was up to him to kill Hitler. As chief of staff of the replacement army, it would have to be left to him, since Fromm had not been won over completely and could not be definitely counted on, to direct the troops that were to seize Berlin after Hitler was out of the way. And he had to carry out both objectives on the same day and at two spots separated by 200 or 300 miles. The Führer's headquarters, whether on the Obersalzberg or at Rostenburg, and Berlin. Between the first and the second acts, there must be an interval of 2 or 3 hours while his plane was droning back to the capital, during which he could do nothing but hope that his plans were being energetically initiated by his confederates in Berlin. That was one trouble, as we shall shortly see. There were others. One seems to have been an almost unnecessary complication that sprang up in the minds of the now desperate conspirators. They came to the conclusion that it would not suffice to kill Adolf Hitler. They must at the same time kill Göring and Himmler, thus ensuring that the military forces under the command of these two men could not be used against them. They thought, too, that the top generals at the front who had not yet been won over would join them more quickly if Hitler's two chief lieutenants were also done away with. Since Göring and Himmler usually attended the daily military conferences at the Führer headquarters, it was believed that it would not be too difficult to kill all three men with one bomb. This foolish resolve led Stauffenberg to miss two golden opportunities. He was summoned to the Obersalzberg on July 11th to report to the Führer on the supply of badly needed replacements. He carried with him on the plane down to Berchtesgaden one of the Abwehr's English-made bombs. It had been decided at a meeting of the plotters in Berlin the night before that this was the moment to kill Hitler, and Goering and Himmler as well. But Himmler was not present at the conference that day, and when Stauffenberg, leaving the meeting for a moment, rang up General Olbricht in Berlin to tell him so, stressing that he could still get Hitler and Goering, the general urged him to wait for another day when he could get all three. That night, on his return to Berlin, Stauffenberg met with Beck and Olbricht and insisted that the next time he must attempt to kill Hitler, regardless of whether Goering and Himmler were present or not. The others agreed. The next time was soon at hand. On July 14th, Stauffenberg was ordered to report the next day to the Führer on the replacement situation. Every available recruit was needed to help fill the gaps in Russia, where Army Group Center, having lost 27 divisions, had ceased to exist as a fighting force. That day, the 14th, Hitler had moved his headquarters back to Wolfschanze at Rastenburg to take personal charge of trying to restore the Central Front, where Red Army troops had now reached a point but 60 miles from East Prussia. Again, on the morning of July 15th, Colonel Stauffenberg set out by plane for the Führer's headquarters with a bomb in his briefcase. There is disagreement among the historians whether Stauffenberg set out for Rastenburg or the Obersalzberg. The two most authoritative German writers on the subject, Eberhard Zeller and Professor Gerhard Ritter, give contradictory accounts. Zeller thinks Hitler was still at Berchtesgaden, but Ritter is sure this is a mistake and that the Führer had returned to Rastenburg. Unfortunately, Hitler's daily calendar book, which has proved an unfailing guide to this writer up to this point, was not captured intact and does not cover this period. But the best evidence, including a report on Stauffenberg's movements drawn up at Führer headquarters on July 22nd, indicates pretty conclusively that on July 15th, Hitler was at Rastenburg and that it was there that Stauffenberg planned to kill him. Though the two places from which Hitler tried to conduct the war, he was rarely in Berlin, which was being unmercifully bombed, were about equidistant from the capital, Berchtesgaden, being more centrally located and near Munich, where the army garrison was believed to be loyal to Beck, had certain advantages over Rastenburg for the conspirators. This time the conspirators were so certain of success that it was agreed that the first Valkyrie signal, for the troops to start marching in Berlin and for the tanks from the Panzer School at Kramtnitz to begin rolling toward the capital, should be given 2 hours before Hitler's conference, scheduled for 1 p.m., began. There must be no delay in taking over. At 11 a.m. on Saturday, July 15th, General Olbricht issued Valkyrie 1 for Berlin, and before noon troops were moving toward the center of the capital, with orders to occupy the Wilhelmstrasse quarter. At 1 p.m., Stauffenberg, briefcase in hand, arrived at the Führer's conference room, made his report on replacements, and then absented himself long enough to telephone Olbricht in Berlin to say, by prearranged code, that Hitler was present and that he intended to return to the meeting and set off his bomb. Olbricht informed him that the troops in Berlin were already on the march. At last, success in the great enterprise seemed at hand. But when Stauffenberg returned to the conference room, Hitler had left it and did not return. Disconsolate, Stauffenberg hurriedly rang up Olbricht with the news. The general frantically canceled the Valkyrie alarm, and the troops were marched back to their barracks as quickly and as inconspicuously as possible. The news of still another failure was a heavy blow to the conspirators, who gathered in Berlin on Stauffenberg's return to consider what next to do. Goerdeler was for resorting to the so-called Western solution. He proposed to Beck that both of them fly to Paris to confer with Field Marshal von Kluge on getting an armistice in the West, whereby the Western Allies would agree not to push farther than the Franco-German border, thus releasing the German armies in the West to be shunted to the Eastern Front to save the Reich from the Russians and their Bolshevism. Beck had a clearer head. The idea that they could now get a separate peace with the West, he knew, was a pipe dream. Nevertheless, the plot to kill Hitler and overthrow Nazism must be carried out at all costs, Beck argued, if only to save Germany's honor. Stauffenberg agreed. He swore he would not fail the next time. General Olbricht, who had received a dressing down from Keitel for moving his troops in Berlin, declared that he could not risk doing it again, since that would unmask the whole conspiracy. He had barely got by, he said, with an explanation to Keitel and Fromm that this was a practice exercise. This fear of again setting the troops in motion until it was known definitely that Hitler was dead was to have disastrous consequences on the crucial following Thursday. On Sunday evening, July 16th, Stauffenberg invited to his home at Wannsee a small circle of his close friends and relatives. His brother, Berthold, a quiet, introspective, scholarly young man who was an advisor on international law at naval headquarters, Lieutenant Colonel Kaiser von Hofacker, a cousin of the Stauffenbergs and their liaison man with the generals in the West, Count Fritz von der Schulenburg, a former Nazi who was still deputy police president of Berlin, and Trotz zu Solz. Hofacker had just returned from the West, where he had conferred with a number of generals, Falkenhausen, Stulpnagel, Speidel, Rommel, and Kluge. He reported an imminent German breakdown on the Western Front, but, more important, that Rommel would back the conspiracy regardless of which way Kluge jumped, though he still opposed killing Hitler. After a long discussion, the young conspirators agreed, however, that ending Hitler's life was now the only way out. They had no illusions by this time that their desperate act would save Germany from having to surrender unconditionally. They even agreed that this would have to be done to the Russians as well as to the Western democracies. The important thing, they said, was for Germans, and not their foreign conquerors, to free Germany from Hitler's tyranny. They were terribly late. The Nazi despotism had endured for 11 years, and only the certainty of utter defeat in a war which Germany had launched, and which they had done little to oppose, or in many cases not opposed at all, had roused them to action. But better late than never. There remained, however, little time. The generals at the front were advising them that collapse in both the East and the West was probably only a matter of weeks. For the plotters, there seemed to be only a few more days left to them to act. The premature march of the troops in Berlin on July 15th had aroused the suspicions of OKW. On that day came news that General von Falkenhausen, one of the leaders of the plot in the West, had been suddenly dismissed from his post as military governor of Belgium and northern France. Someone, it was feared, must be giving them away. On July 17th, they learned that Rommel had been so seriously wounded that he would have to be left out of their plans indefinitely. The next day, Gerdler was tipped off by his friends at police headquarters that Himmler had issued an order for his arrest. At Stauffenberg's insistence, Gerdler went, protesting, into hiding. That same day, a personal friend in the Navy, Captain Alfred Kranzfelder, one of the very few naval officers in on the conspiracy, informed Stauffenberg that rumors were spreading in Berlin that the Führer's headquarters were to be blown up in the next few days. Again, it seemed that someone in the conspiracy must have been indiscreet. Everything pointed to the Gestapo's closing in on the inner ring of the conspiracy. On the afternoon of July 19th, Stauffenberg was again summoned to Rastenburg to report to Hitler on the progress being made with the new Volksgrenadier divisions, which the replacement army was hurriedly training to be thrown in on the dissolving Eastern Front. He was to make his report at the first daily conference at Führer headquarters the next day, July 20th, at 1 p.m. General Adolf Heusinger, chief of operations of the Army High Command, recounts that on July 19th, the news from the Ukrainian front was so bad that he inquired at OKW whether the replacement army had any troops in training in Poland which might be thrown into the Eastern Front. Keitel suggested that Stauffenberg be summoned the next day to advise them. Heusinger, Befehl im Widerstreit, page 350. Field Marshal von Witzleben and General Hoeppner, who lived some distance outside Berlin, were notified by Stauffenberg to appear in the city in good time. General Beck made his last-minute preparations for directing the coup until Stauffenberg could return by air from his murderous deed. The key officers in the garrisons in and around Berlin were apprised that July 20th would be Der Tag. Stauffenberg worked at the Bendlerstrasse on his report for Hitler until dusk, leaving his office shortly after 8 o'clock for his home at Wannsee. On his way, he stopped off at a Catholic church in Dahlem to pray. Fitzgibbon says, 20 July, page 150, it is believed that he had previously confessed, but of course could not be granted absolution. The author recounts that Stauffenberg had told the Bishop of Berlin, Cardinal Count Preising, of what he intended to do, and that the bishop had replied that he honored the young man's motives and did not feel justified in attempting to restrain him on theological grounds. Heusinger, Befehl im Widerstreit, page page 152. He spent the evening at home quietly with his brother, Berthold, and retired early. Everyone who saw him that afternoon and evening remembered that he was amiable and calm, as if nothing unusual was in the offing.